Being excluded feels horrible. Children in the playground deliberately leaving out a child they don't like. A group of work colleagues going out for a drink, deliberately not telling one of their number where they're going. Even worse is religious exclusion, being told that you're not a proper Christian, not a true member of the people of God. If you care about God and his purposes, that hurts. This was the experience of the Christians in a town called Philadelphia. Nothing to do with soft cheese. It was named that way after a Greek ruler who was particularly kind above and beyond the call of duty to his brother. And so the brother named the town Philadelphia because he had such a loving brother. It's one of the seven churches that the letter of Revelation was written to. And it seems they had been shut out by the local synagogue. The Jews who worshipped there said that they were the true followers of God, and the Christians were not. What's worse, anyone who attended the local church was now not allowed to attend the synagogue as well. And some of the Christians had a Jewish background and still enjoyed meeting at the synagogue as well. And so this would have stung for them with double the pain. It also seems that the antagonism from the Jews had rubbed off, and the other people in the town who were not Jews were becoming antagonistic towards this church. Christians today have the same experience. One Christian church being made to feel that they're not the real thing by another. In parts of the world where Christians are in a minority, they sometimes get on fabulously with their maybe Muslim neighbours. But elsewhere, they're made to pay additional taxes that Muslims don't have to pay, or they're forbidden from starting a business. They're told that they're not really a part of God's plan for that particular country, and they can do so little about it. Their numbers are too small to have any influence on the laws that get passed. And in the West, sometimes it's Christians being given the cold shoulder by our secular society. It hurts. And it can be hard to keep going if you get treated like that for long. Which is why it's wonderful to read the words that Jesus speaks to the church in Philadelphia. These are the words that will help us keep going if ever we find ourselves in that position. These are the words that will help brothers and sisters around the world keep going, and that will therefore help us to pray for them. They are gentle words, kind words, positive words. Such a contrast to last week. It seemed last week that the church in Sardis had nothing good about them. Then we come to Philadelphia and we meet a church about which Jesus has nothing bad to say. We've heard Jesus address other churches that thought they were fine, upstanding Christians. And Jesus has had to tell them that they're not. Maybe it's their lack of love. Maybe it's the way they draw their morality from the unbelieving world. But Jesus had to tell them that they are not true Christians after all. With Philadelphia, it's the reverse. These were people being told by the world that they're not true Christians. And Jesus just wants to reassure them gently, encouragingly, keep going. You are. You are real Christians. Which is just a reminder that we have to be careful applying these messages to the churches. There are seven very different churches in Revelation 2 and 3. Between them, they cover the whole gamut of things that a church today might need to hear. So we need to make sure that we apply the right bits for where we are. We mustn't hear words of comfort if what we need is a warning. And we mustn't hear a warning if what we need is comfort. Well, Philadelphia needed comfort, and Jesus gives it to them in spades. Jesus knows this church well, and the one thing he knows about them is that they are small. They are not desperately impressive. They're not terribly strong. Verse 8, he says, "I know that you have little strength." It's good to discover that small, weak churches are in the Bible. We are a church here of about 100 in a village of 4,000 or 5,000. Nothing desperately impressive about us either. And yet they've kept going. I know that you have little strength, yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. The pressure was on them to deny the name of Jesus. We don't really follow him. Or to deny the word of Jesus. We don't believe those unpopular things that he taught. They've done neither. In their smallness, in their weakness, they've kept going. I'm sure you heard in the news this last week of Marmite Gate. In case you didn't hear, if you were on the planet Mars or something, Tesco stopped stocking Marmite. So you had kind of cartoons of, you know, father and son walking along a street, so that sort of pencil sketch, speech bubble. Dad, what did Marmite taste like? Unilever make it, and they wanted to put up the wholesale price. And you might think that Tesco is a big company. Okay, Tesco is worth about £16 billion. Surely they can afford to put their foot down, demand whatever prices they want. Well, Unilever are worth about £105 billion. They're nearly seven times the size of Tesco. So they can afford to stand their ground and refuse to be bullied by little Tesco. It's a David and Goliath story. Now, it's all sorted out now, and Marmite is back on the shelves. Exactly how they sorted it out, we'll never know. The Christians in Philadelphia were in a far smaller minority. Goodness knows how they held their ground, held on to Jesus and his word in such small numbers. But they've done well. And now Jesus wants to tell them what he will do for them. And it's three things. First, he will admit them. He will admit them. Verse 8, I know your deeds. See, I have placed before you an open door that no one can shut. These Christians may have been shut out of the local synagogue. Those that shut them out may have thought these Christians were shut out of heaven itself. So Jesus will personally admit them. He stands there with the door open to welcome them. And because he's on the door, nobody will shut it. One really good thing that Trinity School set up from the day they started was that the head teacher would stand at the door of the school to shake each child's hand as they arrive for the day. And I was talking this last week to Matthew Paulson, the head teacher, and he was saying he now gets to shake 460 hands every morning. It's a simple thing. It treats every child with respect as a person made in God's image. If heaven had a door, then Jesus stands at the door. He holds the keys, he decides who comes in and who stays out. And he's there to welcome these Christians from Philadelphia, to shake the hand of every one as they arrive at the door and say, welcome home. And he's there to welcome the Christians from Kensing as well. See, I've placed before you an open door which no one can shut. He will admit them. Second, he will vindicate them. He will vindicate them. Verse 9, I will make those who are of the synagogue of Satan, who claim to be Jews, though they are not, but are liars, I will make them come and fall down at your feet and acknowledge that I have loved you. They are beautiful words. These Christians are being told that God is not interested in them. That might be what it looks like. Unimpressive bunch that they are. The reality could not be more different. One day, the very people who are dismissing them will see the reality. They will come and fall down at your feet and acknowledge that I have loved you. The thing about God's love is that you can't see it. There's no need to turn there, but Paul addresses that in Romans chapter 5. He says that you can see God's love when you look at the death of Jesus. What kind of person might someone possibly want to lay down their life for? Just possibly for someone really good. A really decent and upstanding citizen. Someone else might put their life on the line for them because they're so good. If you're a Christian, Jesus died for you. What were you like when he did that? Not good or desirable at all. Selfish, sinful, under God's judgment, deserving his punishment. And he died for you like that. That's real love. Maybe you don't feel special to God. Maybe at times others make you feel like you're nobody special to God. If you are one of those for whom Jesus died, then nothing could be further from the truth. He loves you deeply. He cares about you more than anybody else you've ever met. And here is the point. One day that love will be visible for all to see. One day everyone will be able to see just how much God has loved you, just how much Jesus has loved you, and that will include those who told you God had no interest in you. Everyone will be fawning at your feet, eager to spend time with those who are so loved by God. It means every Christian is a celebrity. You know how it works if you're a celebrity. You don't know this from first-hand experience, I take it. But everyone, you know, in the street, selfie, look who I saw today. Autograph, whatever it might be. Photograph, look who I met. You're name-dropping for the rest of your life. I met whoever it was. You can't get away from it. Every Christian is a celebrity. You see, if you're a Christian, you are so loved by God, you're so special, you're so wonderful, that the day will come when everybody wants a bit of you. Except there'll be so many of us that everyone will want a bit of all of us. But those who one day thought that Christians were just an irrelevance to be sneered at and dismissed will just see the reality so, so differently. Jesus will vindicate them. And then third, he will protect them. He'll protect them. Verse 10. Since you have kept my command to endure patiently, I will also keep you from the hour of trial that is going to come on the whole world to test the inhabitants of the earth. There are more trials to come. They won't just affect the Christians, they will affect everyone who lives in that part of the world. These Christians aren't out of the woods yet. They've come through a tough time, and there's more to come. And when those future trials come, Jesus will protect them. He says he will keep them from the hour of trial, which could mean he will protect them from even experiencing the trials. They'll be immune. That's unlikely, given that this is coming on the whole world. It's more likely he'll keep them from being hurt by the trials. They'll be protected. They'll have the strength they need to remain faithful to Jesus in what's about to come. The night before Jesus died, he prayed for his disciples. He prayed for us. It's in John 17, if you want to look later. He said this, "My prayer is not that you take them out of the world, but that you protect them from the evil one." They won't be removed from the sphere of trouble. They'll be kept safe within it. There's a lovely story in the Old Testament in the time of Elisha the prophet. It's 2 Kings chapter 6. The king of Aram attacks the nation of Israel. Elisha's servant sees the massive army camped outside Samaria, and he panics. "What shall we do?" he asks Elisha. And then we get 2 Kings chapter 6, verses 16 and 17. "Don't be afraid," the prophet answered. "Those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And Elisha prayed, "Open his eyes, Lord, so that he may see." Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. That's the picture of this church as they go into the next time of testing. They won't be able to see it, just as they cannot see God's love for them. But they are being protected in those trials. If they choose to do so, they will be able to remain faithful to the Lord Jesus through them. He will protect them. Which gives them all they need to do to hold on to what they have. Verse 11, hold on to what you have so that no one will take your crown. As we said with Smyrna, this is not the crown of a king, it's the crown of the victor, the winner's prize, the equivalent to our gold medal at the Olympic Games. Jesus will hand out the prizes on prize day. And the church in Philadelphia has been faithful under great pressure, so the crown is theirs. All they have to do is keep going on as they are to hold on. And for those who do hold on to the end, Jesus gives them two wonderful pictures of the future. The pillar and three names. The pillar first, verse 12. The one who is victorious, I will make a pillar in the temple of my God. Never again will they leave it. You don't need me to explain a pillar to you. You've got three or four great big ones just there. A pillar stands for something permanent, stable, and secure. These Christians will have a permanent place in God's household. They will be part of the furniture. They might have been kicked out of the synagogue, but they will never be kicked out of the royal household of God. But there's a risk that what I've just done, explaining the picture of a pillar, kills it slightly. Because the thing about picture language is that it's meant to be vivid, enjoyed as a picture. So think of it this way. They've had the doors shut on them by the local synagogue. But Jesus holds the keys. He opens the door so that these Christians can come in. But not just come in, but be pillars, no less, in the palace. And then there's the other picture here. Three names. Verse 12 goes on. I will write on them the name of my God, and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which is coming down out of heaven from my God. And I will also write on them my new name. I don't know how to picture having a name written on you. I picture God getting out an indelible marker and just writing these new names on their foreheads. Or it's like the Old Testament high priest who wore clothing with the names of the tribes of Israel engraved on. So it's like a badge. Or a uniform. You work at Tesco's, you put on the Tesco uniform that says Tesco's on it. They're wearing the logo, the identity. They are part of the team of these three names. The name of my God, they're part of the people of God. The name of the city of my God, they are citizens of heaven. Although notice that the ultimate hope is that heaven will come to earth. The city will come down. And when it does, these folk will have every right to live there. And then Jesus speaks of my new name. They have a special and unique relationship to Jesus himself. Some of you have obtained British citizenship, or you know others who have been through that process. One of my great joys was countersigning the passport application forms for Henk and Lilani and Devan and Danielle. It was the end of a long process for them. You've jumped all the hoops. You've qualified. And finally, you hold in your hand your very own British passport. Some in this church are still waiting for that day to come. It says that this is where you belong. This country is home. You can come here anytime you like without having to get permission to do so. You can just walk in. That's the promise held out to every Christian who keeps going through trials. They are citizens of heaven, with every right to be there. God's children, Jesus' brothers and sisters. Three wonderful new names written on them. Sometimes you might be shut out or made to feel small because you follow Jesus. Sometimes you'll see this happening to Christians in other parts of the world on an epic scale, and it's really depressing. We need to see the full picture. There are realities we cannot see, but that Jesus tenderly speaks about to the church in Philadelphia. No church is small. You might feel small, but you're not if the King of Heaven is on your side. He holds the keys. He is the one who will admit you to heaven, who will vindicate you as the dearly loved person that you are, who will protect you. So, hold on to what you have, and don't let anyone take your crown.